Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Well podcast. I am your host Q, and I have a very special guest on this special interview series where I am joined by none other than our CEO and founder, Adam O'Brien. We're going to be talking a lot about financial security. Adam has written quite a few pieces over the last couple of weeks about this topic. And rather than try to explain anything that he's written, I'm just going to go ahead and hand the mic off right to you, Adam. Welcome to the pod.
Oh man, thanks. It's great to be here. Love what you've been doing. I tell you all the time in our meetings, but I will formally and publicly acknowledge the great work of our host Q. And really appreciate that. And I think this is such a, man, Bitcoin Well, I think is such an interesting, in such an interesting spot because we serve, of course, a lot of American clients, but you know, me and more than half the team still is Canadian. And I think roughly two thirds of our clientele is Canadian. And I can't help, I've been feeling this way for the better part of about 2 years now, that Canada feels like the testing ground for whatever the globalist agenda, the like demonic, you know, globalist, socialist agenda is. It feels like Canada has become their ideal playground to see how much they can get away with before they push it out to the world. And of course, all organizations do this. We all have a small test market that is similar or adjacent to the larger, broader subset of the market. And when you look at it through the lens, through the objective lens like this, Canada is kind of the perfect playground for the globalists to see what they can get away with, to see what, how they can blindside it. And like the joke amongst Canadians is that like the bank is basically an arm of the state at this point. We are Monopoly City. We have monopolized everything in Canada. We've got monopolized banks. We've got monopolized telecom. We've got monopolized internet. Everything is one step removed from the government. And our government's not even really Canadian at this point. We have a British central banker as the leader of the country. And it's just, it's become very apparent to me that they are going after our financial autonomy. And you can see this playing out in real time. And what shocks me is that Canadians still have the ability to buy Bitcoin relatively privately. And I think that's a really important opportunity that we cannot sleep on as Canadians. You know, most of you who know me, who know my story, I'm the most debanked man in Canada. You don't get much more debanked than me. I'm federally debanked. I have been this way for nearly 10 years now. It's part of, you know, the meme, like what radicalized you. It's like losing every single bank account across the country radicalized me. There's stories and documentation of me like traveling across the country with $1 million in a backpack in cash because I literally had no bank account to operate the business. And so when I feel like I'm uniquely positioned to speak on this topic because I have been targeted by this banking monopoly, which is of course the arm of the state or an arm of the state. And, you know, I feel very fortunate that we own the infrastructure to be able to offer, financially private, which by the way, financial privacy is not a crime. You know, people often say, well, why do you need all this privacy? Why do you, it's like, you know, we're writing the series right now. And the idea that the list is a weapon is kind of what comes to mind. And so, yeah, there's a whole bunch of rambly thoughts for you, but I think at the end of the day, it's important to remember that financial privacy is a right. You do not, you know, you don't walk around with your salary pasted across your forehead, not because you have something to hide, but just because it's bad taste to reveal that level of sensitive data. And now we, you know, reveal not only our salary, but we reveal all of our transactions, how we spend our money. You can tell a lot about a person by their bank statement. And that bank statement is available to tens of thousands of people across the world. Bitcoin came to change the way the banking industry works. And of course, that's a debasement. That's the, you know, the theft through inflation and the, you know, the bare assetness of Bitcoin. But I think also part of it is the privacy angle and the fact that we get to reclaim some of our personal autonomy and our financial rights.
No, that was a perfect way to kick it off. And I will just remind everyone watching, if you want to use the only non-custodial exchange available in the United States, one of the only non-custodial exchanges available in the U.S., if self-custody is a priority, hop on over to bitcoinwell.com, create an account, use promo code podcast. You'll get some extra little wishing well points where you can earn free Bitcoin. But most importantly, I can keep bringing you these excellent interviews. But I want to kind of just double click on something that you were just talking about, Adam, and just pose this question. Most Canadians, and frankly, most people think that their bank account is private. Legally speaking, is that the case?
No, not even close, man. When you go to the bank and you tell the bank, hey, I want to deposit this check. Maybe you're like me and you get like two checks a year. And maybe you're not like me and you have a bank account that you can go to. And you go to the bank, you deposit that check. That bank teller, who, let's just remind everyone, that bank teller is generally 25 to 35 years old. It's generally, some supplementary income for the household. And they're generally a, working mom. Not a high paying job, okay? It's like one rung, being a bank teller is, I would say, one rung above being like a fast food teller. Like it's very low paying, maybe $25 an hour kind of thing. And so that, like, what I will call, a low paying job, she gets to log in and have access to all of your transaction history. And this is crazy. This idea that someone who is the first layer into your bank just boom gets access to your financial history. And you might argue, sure, maybe there's background check, maybe there's all this. None of that matters, because at the end of the day, you are only as good, your financial transaction, your financial privacy is only as protected as the lowest common denominator that your bank hires. And this, if you think about it, is kind of a crazy concept, because your bank, especially in Canada, you have five banks to choose from in Canada. Six, if you count like all the low credit union stuff. But for the majority of Canadians, you have five banks to choose from, and they have tens of thousands of employees. Now, do we think that the banks, who, by the way, are the number one accused money launderers in the country, do we think they, who can't get a grip on their financial crimes and where the money goes, they get fined like crazy, do we think they have a perfect track record for hiring? No. But if you want your financial privacy to be relatively clean, you kind of need them to have a perfect track record. Because if one person leaks or decides to look at or exposes your financial data, it's there forever. We know the internet doesn't forget, right? We have many Snapchat problems, recording that the internet doesn't forget. And when your financial transactions live on the internet, which of course they do, then you have a problem if they get leaked. And now you might ask, well, no, I have nothing to hide. Well, no, I think you do, because you don't want someone knowing where you bought your car. You don't want someone knowing what debt payments you have. You don't want someone knowing what your routines are. If I can see that every Tuesday of the week you go to a specific restaurant, then if I want to harm you, now I know where to go. If I know that Mercedes or if I see a Mercedes transaction every 3 to 4 weeks, I know that you probably have one or two Mercedes. And so I know that you're in an income bracket that can afford one or two Mercedes. And so I might want to visit your house. And how do I know what house to visit? Oh, well, it's pretty simple. I can just look at where you buy your gas. Look at where you grocery shop. Look at, our financial picture shows us the most intimate way that we live our lives. And it's now available in Canada, especially to tens of thousands of people without so much as consent. They don't need your consent. Of course, they ask for it when you're at the teller. But what if there's a rogue employee? What if, and I'm going to get called crazy for this one, but I have seen this happen in the telecom industry, and I'm almost certain it's happening in the financial industry. In the telecom industry, the gangs, like Hell's Angels and these types of gangs, they actually install plants. They install kids who want to be gang members, and they steal the telecom data from their targets. I cannot prove this, but logic would dictate that there is a similar type of scheme going on in the financial world. And so, you know, your financial data, the entirety of your financial data is one bad hire away from being leaked to the gangs. And when you just put that, it's like, is that a free society? Like, forget the state, forget the malicious intents of the state. Is this the way we want our financial data handled? I don't think so.
I mean, honestly, I believe it, because that about the telecom industry stuff, it sounds like a variation of The Departed at this point, where you just have gang members infiltrating the police force. Like, why wouldn't be infiltrating everything else too?
I have confirmation of this. Like, so I've been SIM swapped many, many times. For those who don't know, a SIM swap. Oh yeah, dude. A SIM swap is where basically the telecom company changes your phone number to a different SIM card. So right now everyone's phone has a SIM card associated with it. And the telecom company that you use, whether it be Verizon, whether it be AT&T, whether it be Bell or Rogers or Telus or whoever, they have full access to change that. And that's good, right? In theory, because if you lose your phone, you want to be able to port your phone number to a different SIM card. Again, same problem as the bank tellers. They've given all of this power to these like $20 an hour employees that work at the front desk of the shopping kiosk in the mall. And so let's take this at face value. $20 an hour, it's like possible but difficult to live. And so if a gang member comes up to you and says, hey kid, do you want to earn $100 an hour? Here's 50 phone numbers. We're going to tap your shoulder and we want you to confirm that you have this number. And then secondly, we want you to port this number. And like in my case, like I have lost probably at this point over 100 Bitcoin over my tenure due to SIM swaps. Because you think they're safe and they're not. And you've got, you know, this is back in the days of like local Bitcoins. Local Bitcoins, like a peer-to-peer trading platform. But if you were the seller, you had to have Bitcoin on the local Bitcoins account. And so we would have coins on there, but it was backed up to 2FA on your phone. And so when you think about your phone, go log into your email, go log into your social media account, go log into your bank, tell me what it asks for. It asks for a phone number. And so, you know, once again, you are now, your financial privacy, your financial data is exposed to the lowest common denominator, which could be the teller. And now it's also the telecom. And, you know, trying to stuff Bitcoin transactions into this same model that is proven to be unsecure is traumatic. It's devastating. And you know, the problem with the way that we treat this whole system is that we understand that we want retribution for people who do bad things. The problem is you cannot punish those who do bad things. You can't differentiate those who do bad things and those who do good things with a sweeping rule. And so when the sweeping rule is identify everyone so we can identify the bad people, often I think the good people get punished more than they get saved from the bad people.
Yeah, I feel like this is a good time. Also, just this is something that we talk about internally, but like I've stopped wearing any Bitcoin t-shirts in public. Oh. And it's like, it's the worst OPSEC in the world. And this is my call to every single Bitcoiner. Like, stop putting that target on your back. Like, yes, some of the swag we get is so cool. Like the Freedom shirt that we have at Bitcoin Well, one of my favorite t-shirts. And I love that, like, it doesn't actually say Bitcoin on it. But like right now I'm wearing a Bitcoin is better t-shirt. Like, this is not something I wear in public anymore. Like, you put a target on your back so quickly. And
I know, man, it's something I've been thinking about lots. And it's, yeah, it is a writing a line, because Bitcoin is, I think for the first time in history, it's an ideology, it's a movement, it's a peaceful revolution, as much as it's a commodity and a financial tool. And 100%. humans love to wear their stripes. I mean, we absolutely love to show the world what we're about. To brag about what we're about, to identify why we're about those things. It's why the storytelling resonates. It's why You know, the marketing is never around the product. It's always around the vision and the why. But yeah, with Bitcoin, and especially the, you know, that Freedom Shirt you mentioned is obviously OPSEC friendly, but especially the t-shirts that we wear, it in and of itself is probably safe. But when you couple that with all of the other financial hygiene that we need to go through, it can be problematic. I one time was walking through an airport. I was wearing a Bitcoin sweater, and I had two TSA agents just like question me extra. And it's was that random? No chance. Does that random? And it's just one of those things that we have to be on the lookout for, I think, and that we want to be extra aware of. And part of that is understanding where your stack comes from and what list you are on because of your stack. And I think that we are past the day right now when I started Bitcoin Well, at that time was Bitcoin Solutions, I actually proactively emailed FinTrack, which is FinCEN, the money laundering body of Canada. And I said, hey, I'm selling Bitcoin. Like, I probably need a license. Can you tell me how to do that? And they were like, no, you don't need one. Like, don't worry about it. This is like 2013, 2014. I have the email. Her name was Rose. Bless her heart. Rose, I'm not going to dox her, but I forget what her last name was. I think I remember, but I'm not going to say it. But and I have this email being like, you don't need it. And so if you were buying Bitcoin in 2013, 2014, 2015, you were probably getting away with buying large sums of Bitcoin with no KYC, no need to reveal everything about yourself in order to do that. Today, if you want to buy a significant amount of Bitcoin, you need to verify. These are the rules. If you live in a Western world, in a modern society, these are the rules and regulations that you need. You know, it's fine to like, you can buy peer-to-peer a couple $100, like whatever. But if you're meaningfully saving your wealth in Bitcoin, it's going to be verified. However, my plea, I want to urge people to, I think they should get really, really technical about having your stack that you buy with your identity, and then having your stack that you buy that is not permanently and cryptographically tied to your identity. And I think that having a what's coined, but not really a KYC free stack, but kind of like that's how we think about it. I think that's an important thing to start thinking about. And once you get your head around how to manage that, you can sleep a little better because you understand that your financial privacy is a little bit better protected.
Yeah, I mean, it just, again, it goes back to this idea of like, and I hate the narrative that Elizabeth Warren always pushes, and I will always point to this story in particular. And we'll dive into Warren in a second because you cite her in part two that will come out at the time of this recording tomorrow. By the time everyone else is watching it, part two will have come out. But Elizabeth Warren talks so loudly about how, oh, terrorists, they use Bitcoin, like Hamas uses Bitcoin. Fun fact, back in, I want to say January of 2024, Hamas issued a statement saying, please stop sending us cryptocurrency. It's too easily traced back to you. You as the sender put yourself at risk. Hamas understands cryptography and the pseudonymous ledger that is Bitcoin better than our own government does. And when less than 1% of Bitcoin transactions are used for illicit activities, but then almost 84% of stablecoin transactions are, it begs the question of like, what are our priorities?
Yeah.
We've never done a drug bust. Go ahead.
I mean, it's pretty clear that the system is not designed to protect us. The system is designed to protect itself and to enslave us. 100%. And, you know, we watch that throughout. I mean, the pandemic is just the best example of watching mental gymnastics fly around for the greater good, right? Like my favorite one, dude, I think about this often, like the arrows on the grocery store floor.
Oh my God.
Is just like what? We put traffic lanes on the grocery store floor. So this airborne secret killer wasn't going, like, it's just, it's so ridiculous looking back at it. And, you know, some of you will say the benefit of hindsight. I was mocking it in real time. But it's that same logic that points to, oh, well, you know, terrorists use Bitcoin. It's like, yeah, they use cars too. You know, they breathe oxygen. Are we going to start, you know, KYCing for oxygen? Are we going to start, you know, demonizing people that use, you know, vehicles? Like, I think in the article we talk about, like, yeah, you know, they use the roads, but we still are going to build roads, right? We're still going to have roads. And
we've never done a drug bust and found Bitcoin. We found a lot of cash.
Totally.
Use a lot of cash.
Totally. And, you know, to their credit, they're using that too, because they want to take cash away too, because cash is kind of the last layer of privacy. You know, the only reason Bitcoin, well, cash vouchers are even possible is because of cash, because you cannot undo that cash transaction. So yeah, I mean, it's a sad reality that we live in, that we are being surveilled at all times. The flock cameras, the financial transactions, the way that we have everything shipped to our houses, we are under constant surveillance. I mean, Edward Snowden rang the alarm on that one. And I think that we would do ourselves a favor to look at the ways we can protect especially our financial data. And we should, just at least take meaningful action towards doing that. I'm not suggesting you, like, you know, wipe the slate and turn into some privacy conscious, like, you know, hood up, mask on type of, like, not going to catch me, don't tread on me guy. But I'm suggesting you maybe start understanding a little bit more about where your data is going and who has access to it when you give it up. And I think if we all did that, we'd all walk around a little more careful. And it strikes me that we'd pay a little bit more attention as to who we transact with.
Yeah, I think unfortunately our generation was the testing ground for so much of the data that we share online in this digital age that we now live in. And, like, I talk about this with my girlfriend. I'm like, I don't want, when we have kids, for us to post pictures of them as babies and as they grow up on our social media. I want that to be their choice when they come of age. But, like, I've literally watched, like, my teacher's kids grow up. I've never interacted with these people. I'm like, I know what they look like. I've seen them from, like, baby to now. I'm like, I find it a little strange, truthfully, like, just ever so slightly. And I feel like as we have more conversations like this, the hope at least is that people, to your point, like, you don't have to go 180 degrees in the opposite direction, but just, like, be more aware, be a conscious citizen, a conscious digital citizen with every single interaction that you have online.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. A conscious digital citizen. We, you know, I bet most people listening have their passports sitting in, it's not sitting in, like, your bedside table, right? It's probably in, like, a fireproof safe somewhere. It's like you probably know where your passport is. Maybe not you, if you don't value your...
I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know where it is.
but like, I don't think we treat our digital citizenship the same way we treat our physical citizenship. I think you're right. We would do good to our future generation to start learning these habits now so we can pass them down. You know, we just don't know what the future will hold. We don't know what the future rules will be. Like, with Canada right now, the state that it's in, with most Western governments, to be honest, with the state that it's in, I wouldn't be surprised to see retroactive rules being used to target people. Let's take an asinine example, like red meat consumption. You know, there's, like, all these studies, red meat bad for the climate and blah, 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 blah. And so what if they decide, oh, hey, well, there was a 30% surplus of climate problems this year. And so we're going to tax in arrears 30% to those people who bought too much red meat. It's obviously their fault. You know, trust the science. You bigot, you terrorist, you yellow banded buffoon. It's obviously your fault. You're the one doing this. And so we're going to tax you, and let's get the mob involved, you know, push the propaganda through the TV that we control, and let's get everyone mad at you. So you pay the tax. And then wouldn't it suck if all of those, if it was a simple AI search, if your transaction data is leaked and everyone can see that you are the bigot that bought all the red meat that caused the, you know, weather to be bad. And your home address is tied to this. Like, are we, you know, look at Elon. Like they were, people were throwing eggs at Tesla's personal property owned by individual citizens to somehow spite Elon, who was cutting costs at the government. And it's like the mob mentality is so dumb and so strong that we have no idea how this financial data can be used against us. And it worries me that we don't sanitize that enough.
No, and I think to your point too, and as insane as the idea of a retroactive tax, like the one that you've just described or over just red meat consumption may sound, remember, the country that I sit in as we record this podcast 250 years ago, the founding fathers were upset over a 3% tax on tea. Whoa. 3% tax. Taxation without representation was the literal foundation of this country, or at least one of them. But we are so far removed from that. We've normalized so many things. Like the federal income tax in the United States was created in 1917 alongside the Fed.
Temporarily.
So right, exactly. A temporary measure.
It was supposed to be temporary. It was supposed to be taken off. Was it 1%? Exactly. It was like just temporary. Don't worry, guys. This is coming off next year.
Yeah. And here we are 100 plus years later, and we pay more in taxes today now. This is always my fun fact about taxes. Our tax rate in the United States is higher than what the slaves' tax rate in ancient Egypt was. They considered themselves slaves because they had to pay 20% of their crop yield. I pay a heck of a lot more than 20% to the U.S. government right now.
Wow, that's crazy. And you know what's I think doubly interesting about that is that it's also the lowest it will ever be. Taxes are not going down ever.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm in California, and like I get into this debate with a lot of friends over like the proposed billionaire tax. And like, look, I am not a billionaire. If I was, I'm not on this podcast. I'm sorry, that's just the truth. When I hit that,
I thought you were here for the love, man. What's going on?
When I reach the Trace Comas Club, like I'm out. You will never see or hear from me again. But like, I also understand the history of how these laws are created, presented, and then changed over time. And naturally, the billionaires who have access to just pick up and leave and go elsewhere will avoid that tax if they can. The government will not collect as much as they originally anticipated, and they'll start lowering the threshold. And before you know it, within 2 to 3 generations, the quote-unquote billionaire tax that we in California voted on ourselves will be a millionaire tax. And we don't need to go into the inflation spiral of like, what will $1 million actually be worth in 50 years time?
Well, that's, dude, that's just it. Like you look at the money laundering laws in Canada, originally in like the 70s, when FinTrack kind of like announced this law, it was a $10,000 threshold. So if you were spending cash over $10,000, you had to report this. And that is the equivalent today of like $80,000 or $90,000. And they've never changed it, the purchasing power style. And so you look at the billionaire tax, like that's an everyone tax in Zimbabwe. that's an everyone tax in Venezuela. That's an everyone tax when you inflate your dollar to no end. And last I checked, the US dollar is inflated to no end. We saw that in 1913, the government played the long game so that in 1940, they could play some funny games. Then in 1971, they could you know, pull the ultimate rug. And then in 2008, they got to print into oblivion. And then in 2022, they got to do it again. And it's like, you know, whether or not you believe in the long con, like the long con is pretty clear. Do things to one generation that trick one generation into approving the next generation's demise or two generations' demise, because we are inherently terrible at thinking about 25, 50 years down the road. You know, some of the great leaders of the day have famously said, you know, I think in decades, I think in generations. And if you talk to your average, the average guy at a sporting event that you go see, he's not even thinking about next year, let alone next decade, let alone the next generation. And we ignore the fact that they change the rules, they hold the money, they deflate the money. The numbers are meaningless. A billionaire, we're going to see a trillionaire, but it's not, there will be more trillionaires in 100 years than there are today. Not because those people are creating more value, and not necessarily because the wealth gap is getting worse, but it will simply be a representation that the thing we are measuring their wealth in is getting less valuable. And when we put arbitrary numbers behind rules and regulations, we are exposed to their ability to manipulate the arbitrary numbers.
To your point, it's worth noting that inflation adjusted, John D. Rockefeller is still richer than Elon Musk.
Come on. Right? Come on. I mean, right? it's staggering to me that we have a population that cannot see this, and that are willingly giving up all of their firearms, both actual firearms, but then also their figurative ones, their power, their identity, their privacy, all in the name. Because I don't know where that narrative come from. Like, I have nothing behind. Like, I, you know, to be crude, like, everyone knows what you look like when you go to the bathroom, but you still close the door, right? Like, no one's walking around the bathroom with the stall open, I don't think. And it's like, what do you have to hide? It's like, I'm just a decent human being, right? I just don't need everyone to see what's going on. And kind of, I take that same attitude with my like financial data, with most of my data, actually. It's like, you know, I don't have anything to hide. I just don't think you need to see that. And I hope that society starts waking up to that fact.
Yeah. I mean, again, it just goes back to this idea of like, we, by design, do not teach our citizens financial literacy. There's like this lack of understanding, and we overly complicate a very dull topic in the hopes that most people just won't pay attention to these things and they just accept it as the norm. Like, our entire lifetime, the US dollar has been removed from the gold standard. But in this grand scheme of the history of the dollar, it's a fraction of the moment the dollar has existed that it's been not backed by gold. But to us, it's forever, because it's our lifetime, and we can only see it from the lens of our lifetime. I want to poke a little bit at some of the surveillance stuff that you talked about, though, because I think it's pertinent around just this idea of privacy that we're talking about. But like, it's not illegal to want privacy, and yet when you call or you ask for increased personal privacy, it almost seems like you're doing something wrong. Why is that? Why have we led our society to that point, you think?
I think it starts with it being very normal, it being normalized to have very little privacy from authority figures. And now, let me be super clear. My children have zero privacy. None of them have a device, but when they do, like, their messages are not off limits to dad. Or mom. Like, you know, you have no privacy when you live in my household. Not because I'm some evil dictator, blah, 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 because my job is to protect you. And so, you know, there's this good quote that's like, I'm a communist in my family, I'm a socialist in my neighborhood, I'm a conservative in my, you know, territory, and I'm a libertarian in my country, and I'm an anarchist globally. And I think that, you know, we've kind of done a really good job blurring the lines between family and territory, to where that line of like communist, socialist, conservative kind of starts getting really messy. 100 years ago, you know, you spent most of the time with your family, most of the time with your parents. You were probably taught by a small number of community mothers. And then you went to work at a very young age, usually with your family, with your dad. That's like 100, 150 years ago. Today, when you turn 5, you leave You're probably before that in a daycare because both parents have to work, and you're put in a room with a bunch of like peers who you don't really know. And so we're normalizing, you know, at that age, you don't really have much privacy. There's like, you know, at that age, you don't go to the bathroom with the door closed. Like, you know, my four-year-old rips pants to the ankles when he's at the urinal. Like, it's all out there, ready to go. You don't have much privacy when you're five. And we normalize this idea that our privacy goes away because we've like fractured this system where you stick around with the people that you trust and love for as long as possible. And I think there's just downstream effects to that. You know, if you are used to trusting a stranger in an authority figure, a stranger as an authority figure when you're seven, when you're eight, when you're 12, when you're 16, what's the difference when you're 25? You know, who cares that this government who's told you nothing but lies, but every single lie comes back to for your protection, why wouldn't you believe them? And, you know, if all of your peer guidance is getting led by the propaganda that they push out, who's to say? You know, how do you actually wake up? And now, of course, we have social media, we have the freedom of information, we have this ability to distribute the real message, or at least cause people to question. But yeah, I don't know. Lots of people don't share my opinion, but all those people also called me crazy when I put all my eggs in the Bitcoin basket, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And so I just urge you, like, look at where the puck is going. You have never had a right taken away and then had it given back. And so let's just acknowledge that, you know, little rule changes have a way of kind of seeping into our society. And I think it's problematic.
I want to get into let's really dive into this. But before I do, I want to remind everyone watching, if you are looking to move a larger amount of funds into Bitcoin, if you need help, if you have questions about, you know, what the right cold storage option is after the cold card fiasco, hop on over to bitcoinwell.com/infinite. Set a time with one of our Bitcoin advisors. We are here to help you. We are here to help you reach self-sovereignty in the way that makes the most sense for you. You wrote that surveillance infrastructure is never used for its stated purpose. And I feel like this is a very important claim that you made, and I want you to defend it, because as we're talking about this, it goes back to this idea of you've never had a right taken away and then been given it back. Like, they just move that goalpost little by little. Have you ever, though, genuinely seen some sort of like surveillance infrastructure, right, be it whatever, that ends up, you know, you were wrong about and they did come back?
I wasn't allowed in any public facility because I didn't take any specific medicines, and I got that right back. So that's a nice thing. It strikes me that that's only because, you know, enough of us refused, and so they had no choice. So I suppose it could go the other way when enough of us opt out. And then maybe that's the urge, right? The urge is to opt out. And the urge is to like reclaim your financial privacy. But I also think we have seen this go terribly many times. We've seen it go terribly in lots of movies. We've actually seen many movies written about this and we've seen it go terribly. I have absolutely in my life experience, like we had one story where we had somebody, this is back in 2017. We had somebody who was a scam victim, at the ATM, and Bitcoin Well does the most in the industry to prevent scams. We're very, very good at preventing scams. But there was a scam victim.
I get so jacked when I say, no, you're a scam victim and I'm right. It's like, I don't know, the biggest, best shot of adrenaline ever when I'm like, oh,
you're the protector, man. You're the protector, 100%. And so we've got the signage, we've got it built into the, but of course, you know, unfortunately, people are going to do what people are going to do. And so there's this victim of the scam victim, And she calls the police, which is great. That's what you're supposed to do. And the police then assumes that I'm the scammer the machine is a scammer. And so I like explain to the police like how the machine works. You know, you put cash in, Bitcoin moves immediately. Here's where it went. You know, like here's, you know, look at her emails. Like this, look at the times. Like it's obviously not the machine. It's like the person on the other end of the machine. It's the same thing, by the way, like the iTunes gift card scam, the SIM card scam, the Amazon gift card scam. Like this scam is not new. Bitcoin is not some new way to scam. It takes an old scam and applies a new skin, a new medium. So anyways, the police officer determined with no warrant and with no, legal precedent that he could seize the machine. I said no. And he then offered to get a warrant, but then noted that he was going to have an armed guard stand in front of the machine until the warrant came, which I think is not allowed. But either way, I was just like, well, that's crazy. And at that point, too, it was like euphoric 2017, 2018, like bull market. So having that machine off was like terrible. So I was like, okay, take the cash. Like, how much is it? 8,000, 9,000. I forgot how much it was, whatever. A couple thousand bucks, like a few thousand, like meaningful amounts of money. So I gave him the cash. He then put it in the police ecosystem, whatever. And I had to go to court to get it back. And I self-represented in court and actually set precedent for the country accidentally. I didn't realize I was doing this about what happens with like these Bitcoin transactions and why the company is not at fault. But if I didn't do that, I would have, that money would be lost. And so again, it's this concept of, it doesn't really matter who's right or wrong. It matters who has the ability to take action. And that police officer had more guns and more power than I do. And it didn't matter what the law said. Doesn't matter that I was right. Doesn't matter that I had more knowledge. Didn't matter that I had the license. Didn't matter. Nothing mattered. What matters is that he had the guns. I didn't. And so he won. And then lucky for me, I could go through the court system. It took me months, took me hours, hundreds of hours of preparation and wasted energy and sideways energy and, you know, all to reclaim the money that I'd already had. And then the crazy part of this was the cops wouldn't give me the cash back. They wrote me a check and I had no bank account.
Oh my God.
So I got this check that I couldn't deposit and I had to fight with them to get them to put it into, I think I put it into like my wife's name or something like this so that she could deposit. It's the system designed to work for those who play by the rules, regardless of what the rules are. And if you're the person that looks at the rules today and says, this is the best, like regardless, if you're left wing, you're right wing, you're conservative, you're liberal, you're libertarian, you're communist, I don't care. Look at the rules right now and ask yourself, are these designed for human flourishing? And if there is a 1% argument that they're not, then you're hooked. Like you're screwed because the system is designed for the 100% rule maker. And if it's not you, you're kind of screwed.
Adam, I love hearing the lore of the early days of Bitcoin. Well, as the newest team member by far, I have to say, as the great Shaquille O'Neal once said, I have to apologize. I was not familiar with your game. You are a straight up gangster and I love it.
Thank you, sir. I documented, I actually filmed traveling across the country with all that cash in the backpack. Maybe one day I'll be brave enough to put it out. I like vlogged it.
That's so sick.
I vlogged like the security agents and like, yeah, the searches and like all this craziness. Dude, you don't run a Bitcoin business for the better part of over a decade. And, you got a little bit of lore.
Yeah, I think this is something that gets lost. And I love whenever I get to talk to clients and customers, but we have been around since 2013. Like we have existed for over a decade now. And we have a long history and track record of doing right, not just by our community and our customers, but just by the moral compass that we, like, each of us lives by, the ethos we live by. So as just one member of this team, like, grateful for all of the steps that you took, and to everyone watching, again, a reminder, come on over to bitcoinwell.com/signup, use promo code podcast, and you'll get some free Bitcoin along the way. I want to show you guys this clip because in a part of the article, in part one of the article series you wrote, you talked a little bit about flock cameras, and I feel like it's only appropriate to share what is a real human interaction that happened in real life. This is not a movie clip. So let's take a look at this San Diego City Council meeting.
The emperor is a fan of flock, and we must continue utilizing flock technologies so that we can follow and surveil the rebel scum as they move from playground to playground, from playground to pool, from pool to gymnasium, because we all know that the flock cameras are not only following the license plate readers, they are following children. They are following children in parks and gymnasiums, and we need this. I need this so I can stalk my ex-girlfriend. Also,
so I'm going to just pause it there. The clip just keeps going on and on. It should hopefully go down in history as honestly such an iconic moment in this whole, like, flock camera surveillance state that we are moving towards. Like, I over the weekend had the pleasure of finally finishing 1984 after reading it in high school. And I can safely say that no one in our government has read or remembers the lessons of that book. Or have they is honestly a very valid way of framing it, because I swear, like, if you wanted to orient the world against what the future that 1984 proposes, decisions like creating a surveillance state where flock cameras can track, monitor cars moving under the guise and promise of this is to help prevent crime, this is to help stop carjackings, to help with Amber Alerts. I know that the Flock CEO went on the All In podcast, and the thread that I want to pull that they, Jason Calacanis and the Flock CEO, whose name Garrett Langley, they talk about how, like, you know, when you're younger, when you're in my position, I don't have kids. The idea of living in a surveillance state, that's not something I am willing to accept. But I find it interesting because the framing that they use is like, when you become a parent, your priorities change. But here you are a parent, and I couldn't hear anything that would align with what I heard out of the Flock CEO to justify the surveillance state being made. Talk to me a little bit about, like, what your feelings are first, just as Flock has sadly been growing very rapidly as of late, but even though you've never watched Star Wars, we'll forgive you for that for now. Like, watching that clip and just, like, everything that you're seeing, like, what goes through your head?
Yeah, I think the difference there is the Flock CEO might trust who gets the data, and I probably don't. And I think none of us have any problem with people trying to make the world a safer place. It's just, if I go around, oh man, I just had a crazy, I'm not going to go this crazy, but like, if I go around shooting people in the name of making the world a better place and a safer place, I think people should stop me. Cause I'd be doing it wrong, right? That's not the right way to make the world a safer place. And I think that enough of us now disagree that putting the entire world under surveillance will make the world a safer place. And I think we're right. I think the data shows that. I think the incentives show that. I don't think we have seen a reasonable piece of data to suggest that when you remove privacy, when you remove rights, when you remove freedoms en masse as a blanket, the world gets better. You know, the pandemic, perfect example of this, blatant overreach of government power and hysteria, and the world was way worse. The world was dark. And I think Flock is going to have a similar effect, but it will be more long, it'll be more long-winded. It'll be less in your face. It'll be the surveillance state will hurt more law-abiding citizens than it saves. And it's like, man, as a society, we have gotten very used to cutting off healthy limbs in order to save a body. The problem is we've been terrible at identifying limbs which are sick. You know, if your arm is infected and you cut it off to save your body, that's a great move. But it would be very, very dumb to cut off everyone's right arm to save one person's body. And, you know, it's the dilemma, right? Would you kill one person to save a million, or would you let a million die to save the one? And this is a deep philosophical question that we're actively letting our governments answer because we are participating and we are accepting the regime in which they are pushing us down. And it has to stop. We need to be proactive in the way that we prevent this level of tyranny and the way that we protect our future generations. Because my goodness, I wish our forefathers had fought a little harder for the gold standard. I wish we'd fought a little harder for inflation-adjusted money laundering thresholds. I'd wish we'd fought a little harder for financial privacy. I wish we'd fought a little harder for food standards and school education standards. And like, can we keep going here? You know, and so I don't want to look my great granddaughter in the face and be like, sorry, sweetie, I didn't fight hard enough. We need to do it. And it starts with us. And thankfully we can do it peacefully. Thankfully we can have Bitcoin stored in self-custody and opt out of a system of tyranny and generational oppression. We can opt in to generational prosperity and generational freedom. And I hope and pray that enough of us do so that we can look back in 80 years and think we did it.
Adam, I want to be respectful of your time. We're going to link the article, both part one and part two, in the description down below on YouTube. Quickly, just shout out to our audience where they can keep up with you on Twitter, YouTube, and Noster. And we'll definitely, I'm going to annoy the crap out of you to come back because I'm sad that this conversation is over. Like I said, we could have gone for hours on end on this one, man.
Let's keep it going, man. Something tells me this won't be my last thoughts about financial privacy, unless they muzzle me. You know, I should have all the disclaimers here. Like, you know, if I stop talking about this, it's not because I wanted to.
Full disclosure, Adam is not suicidal, nor am I.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I like my life very much. Find me on Twitter, Adam O'Brien. Find me on Noster, primal.net/Adam. Find me on YouTube, The Adam O'Brien Show. And yeah, let's keep in this together, guys. We can do it. We've got the tools. We just need the stones. And so let's stay sovereign.
Thank you all. And just a reminder for everyone, hop on over to bitcoinwell.com, use promo code podcast, come join the Bitcoin revolution with us. If you need help, use go to bitcoinwell.com/infinite. I'm going to throw that on the, yep, got the right one on the screen this time. Go on over there, set a time with one of our Bitcoin advisors. We are here to help guide, make recommendations based on what makes sense for you, because what makes sense for you may not make sense for me, may not make sense for Adam. We are here to help. Thank you all. We'll be back very soon.